knees as he cleared the way forward. To his right, the Khan's warhorse stumbled, pierced through the chest by the thick shaft of a Vorgish pike. The stallion's front legs buckled, flipping the horse heels overhead and hurling the Khan into the crush of Vorgs. Instantly, they swarmed over him, chopping and hacking, sending up great gouts of blood and gore as they tore at the hated king of the horse people. A magnificent shudder swept through the horsemen at the fall of their Khan. Like the air going out of a punctured balloon, the attack faltered as a wave of depression and loss swept across their ranks. Into that malaise, Tai thundered. He swept into the mass of Vorgs that ripped at the body of the Khan, his torso stretched taut as a great axe screamed through the air to rend those who stood before him. The Vorgs cried out as Tai bore into them with a fury that caused them to forget about the Slorg in deference to the bare-chested demon among them. As he fought, Tai's laugh rang out across the field of battle, a sound of joy as pure as the clarion ring of church bells. And to that bell the horsemen rallied, racing to be close to him so that they might discover again this joy of battle that they had lost with the fall of their Khan, only to find it reborn, burning hotter than ever in this vibrant god of war. Tai's heart hammered in his chest. He cast his gaze across the horsemen, diminished in number now, but fighting with a lust and vigor that would have brought tears of pride to the Khan's eyes. If this were to be their end, then they would die in a manner that would gain them places of honor in the lands of the dead. Carol's soft voice whispered in Tai's mind, "To the protectors!" Tai whirled his stallion around, gazing off to the west. There they were, gathered together on a hilltop less than a quarter league to the southwest. Dark wall clouds swirled around the hill, lit from within by forks of lightning. He brought his horse to a run in that direction, and the Khan's warriors followed. He glanced back over his left shoulder. The Slorg was closing the gap that separated them. The army of the protectors churned, as if stirred by twin titans. As the distance between himself and the protectors lessened, the fighting changed. The priests had kept their best troops close at hand, and these warriors fought to defend their masters as the protectors lashed out at the horsemen with magic. Although the shielding above Tai glowed white-hot, it did not falter as it had a short time ago. Two full battalions of armored Vorgs counterattacked from the north, but several companies of riders turned automatically to meet that charge. Directly to the west, several thousand Vorgs stood their ground, and their steadiness brought their fleeing brethren to a stop. These now turned to face the horsemen once again. Tai glanced to his left, seeing that the Slorg had closed to within a few hundred paces. Seeing that its target had slowed, the creature let forth a moan that ripped at the souls of all who heard it, sending chills down the spines of the strongest, and sending the weak of spirit into spasms of fright. Its many arms whirled in a frenzy of motion that sent fountains of gore into the air as everything within its reach died violently. "Almost there," Carol's voice whispered in his mind. Not one of the Khan's warriors faltered at the horrific sights and sounds. These horsemen would hold the line with him, whatever their fate, whatever the cost. A lump rose in Tai's throat at the scene. Over 1,000 horsemen, hair and beards stained with blood, battled astride their warhorses, axes rising and falling as they drove forward to help him avenge their Khan. These were men. He faced forward once again, his blue eyes locked on the protectors. Okay. He would take their pet home to them. Carol's mind sailed across the battlefield, taking in the scene below from the perspective of the vulture, which a part of her now accompanied. A flock of the birds had gathered and now circled high above the fight that raged below, a feast that would fatten them for weeks to come. On the floor of the valley, Vorgs, human marauders, and the other rabble that made up the army of the protectors milled about in a maelstrom currently stirred by two giant spoons, the Slorg and the glorious horsemen of the Khan. Several small groups of the horsemen had become isolated from the main contingent, and although they still fought valiantly, they were being cut down by the sheer volume of the horde in which they found themselves immersed. The Khan's other horsemen cut a swath through the vorgs in front of them, making their way steadily toward the cloud-covered hill where many protectors had gathered. The Slorg screamed, partly in frustration at the mass of vorgs that impeded its progress toward the Khan's riders, and partly in the pure ecstasy of its killing frenzy. In blind fury, it steadily closed the gap that separated it from its quarry. Carol watched in horror, waiting. In her weakened state, she had been unable to kill the Slorg, fire and lightning having no effect. Neither had she been able to strike through the massive shielding that the hundreds of protectors had erected over their hill. She had considerable doubt whether she could pull off what she was about to attempt, but the plan would have to do. As she circled close to the hill, Carol slid from the mind of one vulture into that of another, this one wearing a black cowl and having two arms instead of wings. As her mind merged with that of the protector who thought of himself as Rugthal, his body stiffened. He struggled against her, just as the priest Anglok had struggled within the body of Jaradin Scott. As the psychic battle raged, she marveled at how similar it was to the mental wrestling match that enabled her to control elementals. This one was strong, and his consciousness roiled in desperation. Carol closed off one pathway after another, until she had the priest's mind locked in a part of his brain where he could do nothing but observe. With a final effort, she seized control of his body. The sensation was mind-bending. She controlled two human bodies, her own, atop a pinnacle several leagues to the east, and the roped form of this madman. Through his eyes, she looked down the hill to the east. Tai and the Khan's horse warriors were now heavily engaged with a large group of special guards kept close to the protectors. Their charge was faltering as wave after wave of the huge vorgs threw themselves at the horsemen, were cut down, and then were replaced by yet another wave of attackers. The Slorg was now within a couple of hundred paces of reaching the horsemen's southern flank, and only a few hundred paces from where the protectors stood on the hill. She raised Rugthal's arms and cast, grabbing control of the earth elemental, Kavir. A swarm of stones appeared in mid-air, 15 feet above Rugthal's outstretched hands, the thousands of small spade-like spines whirling about one another and changing shapes rapidly as they darted about. Rugthal's arms whipped forward, directing the swarm outward in the direction he now pointed. The swarm shot forward above the heads of the elite guard of Vorg surrounding the hill, diving onto the form of the Slorg, the stones darting in and out like angry hornets. They stabbed at the rock-hard skin of the monster, rushing in and out of its maw, banging at its eyes in a whirling frenzy. If not for the occasional swat at the swarm from one of its arms, onlookers might have assumed that the beast failed to notice the attack. As the Slorg closed within a score of paces to the closest of the horsemen, Carol cast once more from Rugthal, this time sending a fireball that erupted in a great geyser of flame as it impacted the Slorg. Such was the intensity of the spouting heat that the Slorg stopped for an instant. Carol leapt from the body of the priest, that part of her mind merging with the alien soul of the distant monster. For a second, she thought that she would lose herself in the tremendous bloodlust, but then she found that trace of irritation at something other than its target. She thrust into this, her mind fanning the flame to a blistering rage at the gnats who bothered it, the little beings on the hill who had distracted it from what it craved by daring to launch these puny attacks. The rage grew, feeding a different bloodlust stronger than the old. The Slorg turned toward the hill, screamed that terrible scream, and lurched toward its new targets. With the little strength she could still muster, Carol released herself from the mind of the summoned one, allowing her full consciousness to be sucked back into her own body atop the high pinnacle. The ledge spun beneath her, and she stumbled so that only the grip of Kimber's strong arms kept her from pitching forward off the precipice. Her head hurt horribly, and she could feel her shields giving way. Shaking her head to clear it, Carol tried to regain focus. She could not falter. Not yet. With supreme effort, she once more strengthened the magical blocks that she held in place. She only hoped that she could stay conscious long enough. From the look on Kim's face, her sister shared similar thoughts. Carol breathed in deeply of the cool mountain air, letting it fill her lungs and bubble into her bloodstream before slowly exhaling. Once again, she straightened her back to stand tall. Far below, where the narrow ravine gave way to the broad expanse inside the beatific valley of Ariana's Vale, High Lord Raefel stood in front of hundreds of soldiers, his closely held reserve. They represented the finest of his soldiers, men who, up until this point, he had held out of the battle, men who clamored to get into the fight to avenge their brothers in arms who were dying atop the walls of the westernmost fort. As Raefel saw Carol slump to a knee, then right herself to stand erect once more, a swell of emotion filled his chest and misted his eyes. But where was Kim? Surely she should also be within his field of view. Raefel pushed aside his anxieties and focused on what he could control. He turned to face his troops, raised his sword high, and then brought it down in the direction of the forts, a flagman beside him echoing his movements. Then, as a dozen drummers beat out the march, Raefel's reserve strode forward as one. Gar walked alongside High Lord Raefel, the drums thundering in his ears. It wasn't bad as music went, although the only music he needed now was the timpani of battle. For a full night and day, he had been kept out of the battle while he waited and twiddled his thumbs. Might as well have had his thumb up his ass as far as he was concerned. It all made perfect sense to him, the elite reserve being a strategy he and Raefel had used for many years. Let your enemy come against you until he felt like he was having success, and then hit him with a fresh reserve made up of your very best. Shock. Nothing better in battle. Still, being kept out of the fight while your men died before you was the most frustrating thing the old warrior knew. But now that was about to change. Raefel was finally going to let him get into the fight. He wanted to run ahead down through the sequence of forts and gates until the Vorgs surrounded him, offering themselves up to his sword. He whirled his weapon up and around his head, swinging it in massive arcs on each side of his body, letting the wind sing off the blade, warming his arms to the coming battle. Raefel led the way, with Gar immediately behind him, followed by a couple of men with signal flags, the drummers, and then the archers, 200 strong. Gar spotted John, the one his men had started calling the minstrel, for the way his bow sounded when he worked it hard, walking beside the rows of archers, his prominent black eyes visible even from a distance. Behind the bowmen marched the best soldiers in Raefel's army. Gar recognized them. Good souls, all. Behind them appeared the 30 horsemen who accompanied the Khan's son, Larok, their bearded faces visible above the others, since they were the only ones on mounts. As they passed down through the gates and drawbridges of the canyon forts, the sound of the drums warmed his blood. These boys weren't bad. The canyon picked up the beat and amplified it, so that it boomed back and forth like the sound of 1,000 drummers. The synchronized marching of Raefel's armored soldiers crashed in rhythm with the hard central beat, rising to a crescendo as they made their way nearer to the edge of battle. Gar could barely restrain his feet from dancing. Raefel's demons were coming to dinner. Up ahead, soldiers parted to let them pass, Hannibal having given the word to clear the way for the counterattack. The noise of battle rose up to meet them as they approached the front lines. The main wall of the lowest fortress had fallen to the enemy, which now controlled more than half of the fort. The wounded and dying were everywhere, being carried to the rear on makeshift stretchers, dripping blood onto the main avenue so that it puddled in the gutters. At a signal from Raefel, a horn sounded, and the archers ran forward, taking up positions along the rear walls of the fort on both sides. so that they were looking downward into the inner courtyard to the west. Large stacks of arrows lay in bundles, prepositioned along the walls. Another signal, and the drumming stopped, as did the forward march of Raphael's men. Once again, a horn sounded, this time with the forlorn call of retreat. All along the forward sections of the fort, Hannibal's men turned and fled, abandoning the walls in their race back along the streets. The Vorg screamed in triumph, pouring over the walls and through the gates after the fleeing troops. As the running men reached the courtyard in front of Raphael, they turned off into a winding side alley that ran along the base of the north wall. Once more the High Lord signaled, and the flag bearers atop the rear walls spun their flags in a circle, bringing them down in unison. The drums thundered through the canyon as Raphael's reserve charged forward. Gar roared in delight as he ran, his old legs still conditioned well enough that he could keep up with the lads. The warrior was the first to meet the stunned Vorgs that rounded the turn, expecting to see soldiers in panicked flight, but instead finding themselves facing a rush of fresh troops eager for battle. His sword whirled so fast that its arc blurred, cleaving the snarling Vorg in the lead so that the upper half of the man-beast's head flew into the face of the fellows behind him, while his legs continued to run forward for three full strides before realizing they were dead. Immediately, the courtyard filled from both directions. Another signal, and 200 archers unleashed their bolts into the mass of Vorgs, occupying the western two-thirds of the open space. A second volley followed the first. Then a third was directed out and upward. The storm of bolts arced beyond the far walls, to fall into the sea of Vorgs jammed into the canyon beyond. Raphael's soldiers cut their way forward at a run, with Gar in the lead, taking back the courtyard and then thrusting forward into the street, leading back toward the western wall. Another horn sounded, followed almost immediately by a low rumble high up on the cliffs, a few hundred paces to the west of the lower fort. The soldiers on those walls unleashed the rock slides onto the horde in the gorge below. A grun lumbered toward Raphael, sweeping its great spiked club down onto the spot where he had been a moment before, the impact shaking the ground. A buzzing sounded, and arrows began sprouting from the thing's head and neck as it tried to zero in on the warlord. Suddenly, it lost its balance, tripping violently as a soldier hacked off its left foot just above the ankle. The crash of the monster's fall sent puffs of dust high into the air, clouds that glinted in the slanting rays of the late afternoon sun, framing the form of the soldier that had leapt atop its back, his sword rising and falling, sending crimson gore spurting in stinking streams. The Vorgs attacking the fort staggered back before the assault. Raphael's men drove into them in disciplined ranks that shoved forward and out like a wedge splitting a log, the lead elements pushing wide so that the forces behind could surge through, continuing the splitting action. Only Gar and Raphael refused to peel off to the sides. They pressed forward, always at the tip of the spear. The leading third of the Vorgs had been cut off from their trailing support by the powerful rock slide that crashed down on the forces to their rear. With nothing to push them forward and facing slaughter to their front, they broke and ran. Once again, Raphael signaled, and his men poured after the retreating Vorgs at a double-quick march, not breaking the formation that only distorted slightly where it was forced to cross the rubble from the slide. The Vorgs raced directly into the mass of their own horde that filled the lower end of the gorge, fighting to get out of the canyon, throwing the follow-on forces into disarray so that the entire lower end of the canyon seemed to boil and bulge. Amidst that cauldron, the elite soldiers of High Lord Raphael's reserve dealt out destruction, holding their ground at the mouth of the ravine. Ty marveled at the change that came across the battle that raged below the Protector's Hill. The storm of fire and lightning that heated the magical shielding above the Khan's forces instantly stopped as the priesthood tried to stop the Slorg, which had abruptly turned its rage toward them. Ty wasn't quite sure why the beast had shifted targets, but the development didn't break his heart. The Slorg's progress slowed as a great storm of lightning, fire, ice, and other pyrotechnics blasted into it. The elite forces that formed the priesthood's inner guard charged, not at the Khan's men, but at the Slorg. Tai wheeled his horse away from the hill and raced back to the east, the horsemen matching his movements as if they were an extra appendage. To the north, the army of the protectors had reformed and now pressed forward toward his left flank, cutting off any path back out into the open along that route. A half league to the east lay the entrance to the ravine leading upward to Rafel's fortifications, and then Ariana's Vale. Between himself and the canyon, the great army of the Vorgs churned in disarray. Some of the forces turned to meet the charge of the Khan's men. Others struggled among themselves near the entrance, and although Tai could not be certain, it appeared that Rafel was succeeding in pushing the Vorgs out of the ravine with his planned counterattack. Tai was not to be slowed by waiting for the others, no matter how fast they came. He tore at the trailing edge of the Vorgs, cutting them down on the run, adding speed to the stubby legs of those who found no great will to stop and face Tai and the running mass of horsemen a short distance behind him. The noise of the battlefield was deafening. All about him the clash of armor, the screams of the wounded and dying, the howls of battle fury, and the incessant booming of thunder shook the ground under his horse's hooves. The terrific din drowned out Tai's battle cry. If the land of the dead had a sound, then this must be it. Certainly the numbers that were being sent into that realm with each passing second must have thrown the gateway open wide, so perhaps some of the noise was coming through from the beyond. The horsemen, though diminished in numbers, added a new disarray to the masses that lay between Tai and his objective, cutting their way forward through a spray of red mist that dripped from riders and their horses as if it was raining. High above, the gods painted the sky scarlet. As the riders neared the gorge, the sound of drums beat through the other noises. Up ahead, Tai could see the leading edge of the line of Rafel's men holding the passage open for him. In front of them, at the center of the line, the soldiers had created a bulge piled high with dead bodies. Without hesitation, Tai cut his way toward that spot, and behind him, the horsemen of the Khan followed. Suddenly, a wave of arrows arced outward from behind Rafel's line of soldiers, cutting into the Vorgs between them and Tai, opening a short gap. The High Lord's line parted, and 30 horsemen charged forth. A grin split Tai's face as he watched the Khan's son, Larak, lead his platoon forward to link up with his people. When Tai reached him, Larak whirled around to take the lead, guiding them to the place where Rafel wanted them to ride through his lines. Tai followed Larak through a broad gap that opened to allow them passage as wave after wave of arrows passed outward over their heads. Tai glanced back over his shoulder as he led the horsemen up the canyon across the bodies of Vorgs and men that had died there earlier this day. Rafel's lines closed once more as the last of the horsemen passed through. How many of the riders remained? From the look of it, Tai guessed that not more than 1,000 remained alive, many of them slumping in the saddle. So few. Less than 1/3 of the host the Khan had led into battle just hours before. Then Tai turned back toward the east, following Larak's lead up the canyon toward Rafel's 3 forts and the vale that lay beyond. 21. Ariana's Vale, Yor 415, Mid-Spring. Jorthane limped along through the post-midnight darkness, a faint light illuminating the trail to his tent. Twice he stumbled and would have fallen had not Phoban reached out to steady him. Jorthane glanced over at the wizened priest who served as his aide. The small, piggish eyes gleamed in a face framed by long gray hair that hung nearly to the man's belt. His mouth, like a slash in a side of beef, appeared to have no lips. In fact, Jorthane could not think of one redeeming quality in the withered Bobon. He was a coward, completely untrustworthy, and as stupid as one of the Vorgs. Perhaps that combination was what attracted Jorthane to the man. Here was a servant of ultimate loyalty, too imbecilic to think of a plan to undermine his master's authority, too cowardly to try such a plan if he thought of it, and too unpopular to get any support from others should he overcome the first two insurmountable deficiencies. Yes, he was the perfect aide. Ezra Thane staggered into his tent, sinking into the deep pile of throw pillows in exhaustion. He waved Boban away.
"No one is to disturb me until dawn," he yelled after the man. "Have the Conclave of the Nine assembled in front of my tent by then."
Drothane stretched his thin arms over his head, yawning deeply. He was tired to the point that he was having difficulty finding his way into sleep.
Unbelievable.
A day that had started so well had gone badly wrong. He had known that the witch was powerful, but never had he imagined that she could fend off more than 200 priests for such a long time. Yes, they had felt periodic weaknesses in her defenses, but even those may have been traps intended to plant seeds of overconfidence. The High Priest had also been taken aback by the twin counterattacks, clearly well planned and coordinated, which had driven his forces from the canyon and had disrupted his army to the point that it would take at least 2 full days to get reorganized for the final assault. Neither had Drothane anticipated the arrival of the High Country Horsemen. In all recorded history, he had never heard of them asking for help or giving aid to others, content to keep to themselves in their mountain stronghold, maintaining a strong neutrality that kept them safe. And yet, they had dared to join forces with these people, in defiance of his priesthood. So be it. On the morrow, he would send a few thousand of his soldiers along the horseman's back trail, so that the Vorgs might introduce themselves to their wives and children. Had that been the sum total of the unexpected series of his misfortunes, he would have been frustrated and angry, certainly. However, cap that off with the summoning of the Slorg, and it was the perfect end to a dreadful day. Drothane wished that he could do a casting of his own, one that would recall from the dead that idiot of idiots who had gotten the brilliant idea to sacrifice himself for the glory of the destruction that the Slorg would dole out to the horsemen. Rigo always had a misguided sense of loyalty to the dark gods. This time, the fool had offered himself up as a temple of destruction for their enemies, all on his own, without consultation with his high priest or his fellows. Rigo had given no thought to the notion that once the Slorg was finished killing all its initial targets, it would turn on everyone nearby until its bloodlust was sated. Then and only then could the doleful beast be sent back to its realm. The witch. Drothane mulled over what she had apparently done, rejected the idea as implausible, reconsidered, and then rejected it once again. Whatever the cause, the Slorg had diverted from its original target, killing 47 priests and many hundreds of his inner guard before it was satisfied to the point that it could be gated out. Diverting a Slorg was supposed to be impossible. The witch could not have done that. No, it must have been that idiot Rigo failing to clearly visualize his target as the Slorg consumed him. The wistful image of Rigo changed to a table as Drothane extracted his eyes with hot tongs, finally allowed the High Priest to drift off into a deep sleep. 22. Glacier Mountains, southeast of Endar Pass, Yor 415, mid-spring. Cragan raced up the steep hillside, powerful legs propelling his 7-foot-tall primordial form as his arms flung aside any of his soldiers who were unable to scramble out of his way. He could have called upon Oak to conjure an invisible platform on which he could stand, but he felt a burning need to watch from the ridgetop what was unfolding. For more than a week, his scouts had hunted for the Indarian Mist Warriors who had fled the battlefield after Cragan had killed their timeshaper. Their flight had been a wise move, if not a particularly brave one. During that time, Cragan had kept his army marching toward Endar. The progression was not rapid, given his army's foraging requirements. It was impossible to move a force of more than 100,000 swiftly, especially through lands without towns to raid or farms to scavenge. Reaching the crest, Kraken stared out over the evolving battle in the valley beyond, excited by the sight that confronted him. Once again, the time mists flowed down along the steep slopes on the north side of the canyon and into the leading edge of his forces.
So,
Khalil's voice sounded in Kraken's mind.
The Andarian retreat was a ruse to pull us into an ambush.
Just as I said they would, said Kraken, causing nearby soldiers to glance around to see who he was talking to. The Mist Warriors have another Time Shaper within their ranks.
This one uses different patterns than the last.
A sneer curled Kragan's lips.
It matters not. I have a surprise in store for them.
Galad shoved aside his frustration at not being the commander who was leading his Time Mist Warriors into battle, and focused all his attention on channeling the mists within which they would fight. As he had rehearsed with Commander Tempest and her subordinate leaders, he wove the mists that flowed out and cut across the ranks of Kraken's lead elements. The morning was bright and crystal clear, with a brisk breeze that swept down from the glaciers that lay to his west. From this vantage point overlooking the fields of battle, he observed the shrouds obscure all whom they enveloped. As had become standard procedure, he used the mists to separate chunks of Kraken's soldiers, allowing the Andarian warriors to exercise their battle skills. In the meantime, Galad studied the seemingly endless columns of marching Vorgs, some of whom surged wide to either side of the valley, attempting to encircle those who fought within the mists. That tactic was not going to work. Galad channeled new mists, sending the Pommelie fog out in front of the enemies that charged around the Andarian left and right flanks. He balanced the slowing with a fresh river of Rykley mists that his warriors could utilize. The Vorks who charged around the left flank jammed up as the lead ranks struggled into the Pommelie fog bank that blocked their path. Galad nodded in satisfaction as he watched the same thing happen to the enemies trying to flank the Andarians on the other side. He did not have time to savor the moment. To avoid succumbing to the same tactic that Kraken had employed to kill Lycus, it was time to move to his second overlook. Galad stepped from normal time into the first layer of Rykley mist, feeling the familiar drag from behind until he stepped all the way into the accelerated zone. In the canyon far below, he saw new mists form. No longer able to see the bulk of Kraken's army, he did observe Andarians and some Vorgs passing through the winding channel. But Galad did not stop to study their movements, continuing instead into faster and faster mists until he found the one that would take him to his desired destination, while little time passed in the normal world. He stepped onto the overlook and was prepared to make the transitions that would place him back in standard time when he saw something that froze him in place. In the bottom of the canyon, several hundred mist warriors prepared an ambush for the Vorg archers, who slowly emerged from the mist. But to Galad's horror, he saw a broad swath of the enemy archers thrust their bows, arms, and heads through the mist wall, able to release their arrows long before the rest of their bodies pulled free of the slower zone. The Vorgs had adopted one of the mist warrior tactics to devastating effect. Even though the Andarians countered with their own volley of arrows, their warriors dropped by the score. Worse, four of the leather and chainmail-clad Vorgs dropped their bows to launch fireballs and summon lightning. The realization that Kraken's wielders had disguised themselves so that the Andarians could not immediately target them stunned Galad. He channeled two new mists, sending these coursing down the mountainside toward the distant battle. If he had been closer to the front lines, his actions would have allowed hundreds of his people to escape the conflagration. But to Galad's utter despair, he was too far away to observe the subtle swirling within the mists that would tell him what moved within the fogs. Before the first tendrils of these new mists could separate the Andarians from enemies, hundreds more Vorgs emerged to launch the next wave of arrows at the surviving mist warriors.
No!
Galad's cry resounded throughout the open passage that wound its way through the fog, causing some Vorgs to turn toward the ledge upon which he stood. But as one of Kragan's wielders raised his hand to cast a spell, Gallad thrust himself into a different mist. When he arrived at the designated rally point, his dread found its source as the full extent of the Andarian defeat became clear. The survivors numbered less than half of the 1,500 who had followed him from Endar. Of those, more than 100 had suffered serious wounds. He moved among the wounded with Commander Tempest at his side, pausing to give an encouraging word or a reassuring touch, fighting to keep the sickness in his soul from showing itself. Gallad watched as the brigade's two remaining life-shifters worked to separate those who must be allowed to die so that they could treat a greater number of the less severely injured. When he left the wounded, Gallad felt like hundreds of Andarian eyes followed him. He could feel those stares like a lead vest trying to drag him to his knees. Despite his mist-weaving having let them down, these warriors now looked to him to make matters right. As he came to a stop before them, he realized he had no idea how to do that.
"Tempus," he said, fighting to keep his voice steady. "This is my fault. I should have known that I could not replace Lycus."
She placed a hand on his arm.
"My friend, Lycus could not have prevented what happened on this day."
Gallad turned to meet Tempus's gaze.
"You're wrong about that. I should have wielded the mists better.
What we were missing during today's attack was not your ability to wield the time mists. We missed your unique ability to sense what moves beyond those misty walls. We have grown used to you leading us in battle. Without you at our head, we were blind." A sour taste filled Gallad's mouth.
"I cannot simultaneously command mist warriors in battle and channel the mists within which they must fight."
"How do you know that if you've never tried?" The question left Gallad silent for a moment.
"My first attempt to do so should not come in battle. You must resume your command if any of us hope to see Endar again."
Gallad paced slowly back and forth, rubbing his chin as he considered this. Coming to a decision, he stopped, his eyes on Tempest's battle-scarred face.
"Very well. Tonight, we will rest and let the life-shifters do their work. Tomorrow, we will begin fighting our way back to Endar."
"Good," said Tempest. "I will inform our warriors." As Gallad watched his second-in-command turn and walk away, a painful lump formed in his throat. Never before had he gone home in defeat. This time he would return to his queen with less than half of the elite mist warriors that he had led out of Endar Pass. And he would be bearing with him the body of Lycus, the fairest soul he had ever known. Part 4. In my dreams, I see the woman who bears the elemental mark on her shoulder. She stands atop a lonely pinnacle, wrapped in cascading webs of power. A cloak drapes her slender shoulders, its color shifting from white to red as she moves. I fear that she wears the fate of this world. From the Scroll of Landrill. 23. Valdep, Yor 415, Mid-Spring. As much as Alan hated being left behind, he disliked his new taskmaster even more. The leader of the Khan's rear guard was an older, peg-legged soldier named Kron, whose wiry ugliness was surpassed only by his bitter disposition. From all accounts, the man had been a legendary horseman and warrior in his day, and the Khan's guard. All those careers had come to a sudden halt when his horse fell during battle, mangling his leg so badly that it had required amputation. Since that day, the Khan had assigned Kron the task of training the warriors in their weapon skills. He had also placed Kron in charge of the defense of Valdep whenever the Khan was gone. Now Valdep stood defenseless. The Khan had left only one company of warriors behind, along with Alan's platoon of 30 men,
150 fighting men in total. In addition, they had perhaps 400 older men and boys strong enough to bear weapons. The rest were women, small children, the elderly, and the infirm, several thousand in all. Only the incredible natural barriers of the mountain fortress city made a defense thinkable under such circumstances. The clean central street of the eastern half of Valdep wound its way upward through the high palace in front of Alan. The morning sunshine did little to lift his mood as he strode upward. High above, the cooing of the doves caused him to lift his gaze to the towers above the south wall of the city. Barely visible in the distance beyond the gently fluttering banners, black thunderheads climbed high into the otherwise blue sky. A deeply worried Alan shook his head and increased his pace, barely noticing Bill's lanky form behind him. There was little doubt that beneath those shadow skies, men fought and died in a battle that should have been his. And what was he doing in the meantime? Preparing defenses against a possible counterattack? No, not even that solace was granted him. Kron had seized all the tasks associated with getting the men and lads ready for battle, and had named Alan his deputy. Deputy, indeed. Handmaiden was a more fitting title, considering his assignment. Passing beneath the ornate horse fresco carvings of the gateway to the upper palace, Alan returned the salutes of the two guardsmen and walked into the palace courtyard. Just inside, he stopped, Bill coming to a halt beside him.
"Well, I'm ready if you are,"
the young ranger said, grinning at him. It was funny that Alan thought of Bill as young, since he was a year older than Alan. But the events of the last few months had made the Lord feel older.
"Great gods, how am I ever going to get a girl with you this close all the time?"
Alan asked him. Bill just put forth a grin and shrugged.
"Just imagine I'm not here."
"Oh, yeah," Alan had replied.
"That's gonna happen."
Now the two gathered their strength for the meeting they dreaded more than facing a Vorg army. Not more than 20 feet away from where they now stood, they would pass into a meeting hall where a most fearsome audience awaited. The Council of Matrons of Valdep. With slumped shoulders, Alan marched forward once again. The women of the council raised their heads as he entered, his entrance apparently having disrupted a huddle of some importance. The Council of Matrons had been an important fixture of the society for many hundreds of years and was made up of older citizens widely regarded as the top experts in the city in all womanly roles and responsibilities. These responsibilities encompassed a wide gauntlet of tasks, including baking, cooking, tailoring, mending of armor, gardening and farming, general cleaning, washing of clothing, nursing and doctoring, the gathering of food and water from the fields and wells, and on the list went. Even butchering was considered a woman's task, since it fit in with the gardening and preparation of meals. The matrons were not elected. It simply became apparent to others over time which one of the women was in charge of an area. While there had been famous squabbles in years past, where two or more women had vied for a single position, the system worked more smoothly than most political structures. The process certainly produced a group of assertive women, a fact that had become brilliantly clear to Alan on the previous day when Kron had assigned him the glorious task of organizing the ladies in support of the main defensive effort. His initial meeting had not gone well, to put it mildly, perhaps due primarily to his bad attitude. He was certain that his father had not assigned such demeaning duty to the Khan's son. This was nothing short of an outrage, although one he had been given no choice but to accept. As it was, his opening statement was a no-nonsense demand that the matrons listen so that he could assign them tasks appropriate to their stations. What followed closely resembled what Alan imagined throwing open the gates of the deep to be like. He would not have believed it possible to have that many fingers waggling in his face simultaneously. How could that many large older women move so fast? How could so many crowd into such a tight space? How could they possibly yell that loudly and continue for such a long time without tiring?
Thank the gods he had managed to quiet down the group enough that he could beg their pardon for his poor choice of manner and words. Only by promising to spend the evening in the tutelage of the chief matron, who would endeavor to make him understand the honored role of each member of the council before he next came before them, was he allowed to escape with a small fraction of his hearing intact. As he had been instructed by Lorraine, the chief matron, the evening before, the words of the formal greeting tumbled from his mouth as he and Bill inclined their heads in a deep bow.
"Good women of the council, I beseech you to grant me audience that we may discuss matters of great urgency."
The 36 women simultaneously straightened their backs and dipped into a deep curtsy in response, a sight so startling that Alan had to struggle to keep a straight face. Lorraine was the first to resume a normal posture, her movement mirrored by the other matrons.
"You are most welcome indeed, Lord Rafelson."
Alan did not attempt to correct her as to the matter of his name, instead choosing to recover from the ridiculous bow. For more than 2 hours, the meeting ground along with an assortment of procedural matters that seemed to Alan to be designed to waste everyone's time when there was very little of that commodity to waste. Finally, Lorraine clapped her hands twice and rose to speak.
"Matrons of Valdep, this brings us to the matter at hand. I believe that our young guest has come to understand that what he may very well regard as a necessary process and procedure is all that stands between the tasks that he desires our cooperation with and complete chaos. We have not spent 25 generations keeping the affairs of Valdep running like clockwork without discovering that certain preliminary steps are necessary in all matters if we are to conduct business efficiently. In my long session with the young man last night, I must admit that I was at first skeptical that he would be fit for the task of guiding us in our preparations for war. I thought it highly likely that he was merely another noble hothead, all bellow and bluster, only good for swinging that axe of his and little else. But surprisingly, he impressed me."
Lorraine's gaze swept her audience, lingering on Alan for a moment.
"Oh, now, don't get me wrong. Lord Rafelson is most definitely hot-headed. But the heat is the heat of passion. What impressed me is that no matter how distasteful he found his task of being liaison to the matrons of Valdep, instead of to the warriors of Valdep, no matter how much he didn't want to spend 10 hours of the evening and night listening to an old battle-axe like myself, he did so. And not only did he sit there, he paid attention, listened, and learned. And he accepted his role in all this. I sense within this young lord a drive, nay, a work ethos that compels him to do whatever he must to the best of his abilities. Unless I miss my guess, which I seldom do," a whisper of laughter bubbled around the edges of the room, "those abilities are considerable. While he still knows very little of the total that makes up our way of things, Lord Rafelson has a feel for war beyond his age. Therefore, I want you to pay close attention to what he says. It will be the task of each of us to scour his words for guidance, and then to use our own innovative ways to figure out how best we can aid the effort." With a wave of her hand, she signaled that the meeting was handed over to Alan. Alan rose somewhat stiffly to his feet. Oddly, a deep sense of pride swelled his chest. To think that here, in this room full of mature women, he had finally shown the leadership and composure his father had always longed to see Alan exhibit. A flood of new worries about giving false hope to these women and the inherent inadequacies of the plan he was to propose coursed through his mind. But he cleared his throat and continued. "Thank you, Chief Matron Lorraine. And indeed to all of you, the matrons of Valdep. As the Chief Matron has said, we are all but out of time. We can't afford to make any other assumption."
The matrons seated in groups around tables within the room nodded in agreement. Alan stretched out his hand, pointing toward the south wall of the meeting hall.
"Beyond that wall, outside of this city, just a day's ride to our south,
Your warriors and mine are engaged in a terrible battle. The odds are that they cannot win it.
Several gasps around the room showed the shock his statement caused.
I have seen up close the army our peoples face, and it is monstrous. To have any chance of winning, we have to maximize every advantage we have. Our warriors are trained, fearless, and disciplined. We have great natural defensive positions. The problem is that our enemies vastly outnumber us.
As Alan paused, the silence in the room gathered until it took on an oppressive weight. He left the head table to stride among the gathering of stout citizens.
As she said, your chief talked to me last night, and I listened to her counsel. What I learned is that in Valdep, more than in any society I have heard of, the women are an organized force that does most of the work, freeing the men to ride about practicing whirling their axes and looking fine.
Laughter erupted in the room, accompanied by the nodding of heads. Having captured their full attention, Alan continued,
And that is a good thing. You have given your men a chance to be the best at what they do. You have done that by being the best at all the other tasks that make your society function. In a short period of time, a couple of days at most, I expect that a significant portion of that malevolent army will march into your valley and launch themselves against these ramparts, expecting to find the walls manned by a skeletal force of warriors, the old and the very young. Their intent will be to batter their way through those meager forces and then rape, loot, and pillage among the women and children who remain, to take the ones they want as slaves, killing everyone else, burning and destroying everything in their path. We are going to ensure that they are in for a terrible surprise.
As Alan talked, the matrons leaned forward, drinking in his words, a look of cold determination growing in their faces. He talked of how the battle would go, how the ravine that blocked access to the outer wall was a mighty barrier, but not unbreachable. The Vorgs would come at it with ramps and ladders. Some would make it to the top of the wall, where they would attempt to gain control of the gargantuan winches that operated the Khan's ramps. The Vorgs would focus on these, trying to get them lowered so that the mass could surge upward in such numbers that those at the top would be overwhelmed. Once over the outer wall, the battle would be done, since there would not be enough troops left to man the Khan's layered defenses. Alan paced the room as he talked, moving among the tables, although his eyes had taken on a distant look, as if he were even now looking out across the battlefield. Suddenly he stopped once more at the head table, looking directly into the chief matron's steel-blue eyes.
I know what we need to do to give ourselves a chance of victory. But you are the ones who know precisely what all the women under your direction can do, and I will need you to come up with inventive ways to make that work for us to ensure our survival.
Once more Alan paused, sweeping the room with his gaze.
There is one more thing I should mention, which may get me in trouble with you once again. I believe that no matter how well the few soldiers, old men, and young lads fight, it will not be enough to save this city. I therefore have no intention of limiting your rules to only those tasks that Commander Kron has delegated to us. We will plan on fighting this battle as if there were no one out there to fight for us.
He paused.
If you are willing to do so.
A new thought struck Alan, as he looked out over the sea of surprised and enthusiastic faces. Apparently Carol's philosophy of equality of the sexes had infected him. A cheer erupted in the room, and once again Alan found himself on the verge of being smothered by large women. Having moved to a safe place in the far corner, Bill chuckled long and hard. A lull settled over the battlefield for a day after Raefel's counterattack had reestablished control of the canyon and the Khan's men had fought their way into the valley. Kim begged Carol to rest, just for a little while, and in brief stretches she managed to do so. Using the eyes of the vultures, she could see the disarray of the enemy forces, but a massive effort was underway to reorganize the horde for another attack. The protectors probed at her defenses, but Carol's early warning network of minor elementals alerted her to each attempt. But now she saw what she had dreaded.
More than 2,000 Vorgs and their allies had split off from the main body of the army to march north in the direction of Valdep. Moreover, three of the most powerful protectors accompanied them. Alyn was out there. She could feel her brother's desperate need growing. Try as she might, she could not imagine how the fortress of Valdep could stand against the numbers that marched toward it. Not with the remainder of the Khan's warriors trapped within Ariana's veil. It was a choice that the Khan had knowingly made, but his gamble had failed. She willed the vulture north, circling above the division of Vorgs as they jogged along in formation. Come the morrow, she must be ready with enough reserves to provide cover to Valdep. At least Alyn could die a warrior's death, without being blasted off the ramparts by sorcery. A cool breeze ruffled her red-stained white shirt as she rose to face northeast. As Kin stood at her side, tears made their way down Carol's cheeks. Despite his earlier misgivings, Alyn found himself awed by how quickly the matrons organized the women of Valdep and got them moving. Lorraine had placed the youngest, oldest, and weakest of the women in charge of caring for the small children. They had moved this vulnerable population to locations deep within the northeastern part of the split city. This left 3,000 women available who were fit to work or fight. Alyn had taken to calling her Chief. Even though this had initially caused some raised eyebrows, she seemed to enjoy the title. So it stuck. Both she and the matrons under her command proved highly adept at completing a wide variety of tasks quickly. Based upon Alan's general guidance, they had determined how the women could best support his strategy. He had laid out the battle in phases, the first of which would be the initial struggle for the wall. During this phase, the women were to comply with Commander Kron's intent and limit themselves to a support role, delivering food and supplies to the wall and caring for the wounded. The second phase of battle would be when the defenses atop the wall began to crumble. At that point, all women capable of fighting would move into direct combat roles, while the others continued to provide support. The third phase would occur if the outer wall fell. Alyn referred to this as the prepare-to-die phase. They did not bother to plan for it. Lorraine organized slightly more than half the women into support groups that would continue to have the same role during both phases of the battle. Sewing circles became fletching circles, and bakers made the flatbread that would serve as meals for the coming days. Groups of women drew water and routed it down wooden troughs to fill tanks behind the outer wall. Pre-positioned firewood and oil augmented the bundles of arrows, bandages, and other combat support materials. The more challenging task was to convert the remaining women into a capable combat force. One solution was archery. Alyn made clear that he did not care in the least about their accuracy.
If we get to the point that you're having a hard time being accurate enough to hit one of the bastards coming at us, then we've won, he said.
What he wanted was a high volume of fire that would reach at least 100 feet. If a woman could not pull a bowstring that would launch an arrow that far, then she was not a candidate for the position. This turned out not to be a problem, since these women had spent their lives doing heavy manual labor of every conceivable type. An unexpected advantage was that many of the women thus had exceptional manual dexterity. Using quick hands and fingers, they could launch a stream of arrows swiftly, since they only had to aim in a general given direction. The chief selected close to 1,100 women as archers, immediately setting them to work making more stacks of arrows to augment the stockpiles already available and moving them into cache positions near the outer wall. She also set up a flag signaling system for simple aiming and firing commands, such as high, low, right, middle, and left. Moira, matron of the harvest, resolved the problem of how to form a more direct fighting force from a group of women untrained in combat. While none of the women was skilled in the use of a sword, axe, or battle hammer, several hundred women had years of experience in the fields using a farming implement called a ukiel.
which looked like a cross between a scythe and a spear. The Yukil had a pace-long staff that ended in a sharp double-edged blade and a triangular spade-like point. The women used it to harvest both wheat and hay crops, with sweeping strokes that rose